Welcome to the Shark Brains Podcast. My name is Ronald Knoll and I'm one of the co-developers of Wireshark. In this podcast, we will discuss all things about Wireshark as well as topics from the world of packet analysis and SharkFest, which is our packet analysis and developer conference. You will meet interesting people and learn why the truth is always in the packets. With me today is Mr. Kerry Rogers, a long-time participant in the SharkFest, long-time participant in the Wireshark community in general. If you have attended SharkFest before, you might have seen him at the Backhead Doctors, which he will also be attending this year. Welcome.
Thank you. I'm happy to be here, as always, and to talk to you about packets.
Now, you've been a long-time user or long-time participant in the field of packet analysis.
Sure.
How came that to be? What was your motivation to go into that field?
Well, I started in a support role. I was previously like a sysadmin, you know, system and networks, and I would break out Ethereal and then Wireshark occasionally to check very basic things, but my ability to go deeper wasn't really needed, and I didn't develop. I had the basic understanding of what the tool was and what it did. But then I started a new job with Riverbed, and I was in tech support. And this is, you know, this is a box that is inline, transparent inline, and it's meant to make everything go faster. So sometimes it will break, and sometimes it will actually go slower. And it's my job to figure out why. So it became, your two biggest tools are system logs and PCAPs. And I found that the better I got at reading the PCAPs, the faster I could solve problems for customers. And I would look around and see, like, not everyone is doing that necessarily. I felt like it was almost like a superpower. I discovered this thing. Everyone, like, knows. Yeah, everyone should understand packets. But the more I really focused on it, I realized it was a superpower if you could do it. And I could solve things a lot faster than some other folks, I guess.
It's almost a little bit like a treasure hunt. Where you get this picture, what should be happening, and then you drill down into the packets. I mean, I came from industry automation networks, which are vastly different to all kinds of normal networks, so to speak. And I found it fascinating when I first attended SharkFest in Anaheim to attend. I think you were there as well, mm-hmm. to attend your class, because it suddenly, I mean, obviously, I knew about all the protocols and stuff like that, but somebody is sitting there in front of me and doing stuff with it, I'm like, huh, that works? That going?
Yeah. Now, I've learned a ton here. While I was at Riverbed, you know, we had some proprietary protocols, but like where the different boxes would talk to each other, and they taught us to, like, you know, manually by hand decode the bytes. And as a former sysadmin, well, I'm lazy, and like I will not do that. I will write a script. So I started to poke at a Perl script to do it. It's like, wait a second, I already have a tool that decodes packets. Why am I doing this out of band thing? Like, can I figure out how to write a basic dissector? So I took a weekend and figured it out. And I wrote a basic dissector for this protocol, and I started disseminating it to different people, and I started talking to engineering, and oh, that group has their own dissector, and this group had their own, and we all got together and made like the super Wireshark, you know, one to rule them all type internal for Riverbed. And then I found out about SharkFest, and so I told my boss, hey, since I'm kind of like the support Wireshark guy, can I go? He's like, yeah, sure. And it was at Stanford, I think, 2010 maybe. And I'm like, I come in feeling like a little bit of a hotshot, like I know what I'm doing. And then I get in there and I watch Jasper and I watch Hansong and I watch Sake, and I'm like, oh my gosh. Like, I realize what I don't know.
Yeah.
And so, yeah, I've learned a ton from all of them, and I take stuff from them, my own, kind of mash it all together and kind of came up with my own process, which I think that's kind of what everybody does.
Yeah, but it's also what one of the great things about SharkFest is. Although you sit in those classes and think, wow, this is so cool, wow, this is so beyond anything, those people must be really annoyed talking to me and stuff like that. Everyone is approachable. Everyone, you can have nice conversations with everyone. They're sitting there explaining to you stuff. I mean, I had in Kansas City, I was monitoring the IPv6 class with Jeff Carroll. Mm-hmm. And yeah, everybody knows no one understands IPv6, at least of those, the guys who wrote the book about it. And he's one of those guys. But yeah, that was 45 minutes, which really taught me something.
Yeah.
About IB physics. I will still not understand it, but it's I will have more of a less clue.
Right.
To go into it.
Yeah, yeah. The people here are great. That's why I've been coming for over 10 years. It's not unusual to see an instructor and an attendee off at a table looking at a laptop and looking at packets and going over something. It happens all the time. It's a very welcoming, good community.
Now, I want to pick your brain a little bit, because one of the things about packet analysis is it seems to be a non-evolving field. We always get new formats, we always get new protocols and stuff like that, but the baseline of work has stayed the same. One of the biggest things that walks around nowadays is this keyword artificial intelligence, AI. How do you see that interacting with packet analysis, or do you think it has a role there?
Well, I'm interested to learn that while I'm here from you, actually, during your Wireshark and AI session. I don't know, to be honest. I'm obviously, everyone's kind of, it's like a big, everyone's focused on it. It's, you know, talking about it. It's exploding, all the different tools. And I've seen some very impressive results with generative AI and things like that. So how can it apply to the work we do? Can it help find that weird problem, you know, that it takes expert set of eyes and maybe hours of time? Can it do it quickly, especially for large volumes of traffic? Maybe so. I don't know, but I'm very interested to see.
Would you say it's the better approach would be to tackle the issue at the monitoring side, track issues as they are happening, or in the deep end analysis side?
I don't see why you wouldn't come at it from both sides.
Okay.
I mean, certainly real-time, proactive. You're monitoring something. Maybe some model establishes a baseline, and when it goes out of that baseline, hey, raise the flag. Let's not wait for someone to complain about it. But if we know ahead of the customer or the user or whoever, we can maybe start looking into it quicker. And then certainly on the other end, when you've got maybe tons and tons of data and you're trying to answer a question, you can point a tool at it and maybe it can find it for you.
I mean, a similar discussion was going on before AI in the world of network analysis and network protocols was with HTTP/3, with QUIC. People came and said, okay, with QUIC, network analysis is over. There will be no more network analysis. We can't look at the data. What's your experience with it?
Well, I mean, there's always, yes, you lose visibility into a lot of things. But there's always information on the wire that you can get insights from at different layers, at different places in the data and the packets. Today I'm sure people troubleshoot lots of SSL issues. They can't see, you know, the application stuff, but there's still plenty of information in the packet. If you know what you're looking for, what the problem is, you know, I think just grabbing packets and trying to figure out a problem can be a tough approach, but having a very defined process, approaching it, you know, methodically, narrowing down the issue, you can get as much information up front about an issue if you're trying to track it down, then you get more out of the data, even if some of it isn't that visible to you.
Okay, so let's play a hypothetical. You're coming to a customer site, customer is complaining about network being slow. What's your approach? How do you start analysis? What's your vector of attack?
So I'm going to spend as much time as I can without annoying them too bad, or even if I do annoy them, I'm going to ask them 1,000 questions, because customers, users aren't always straightforward or forthcoming. Not that they're trying to hide information, but you get weird answers, and you have to follow those rabbit trails to figure out what's really going on. So you're trying to narrow down the problem. What is it, you know, the application, is it this one application? Is it multiple applications? How many users? Is it, you know, one department? Is it only certain days? You're doing all this Sherlock Holmesing to narrow it down to the most specific use case, reproducible use case you can come up with. So you know all the parameters. Ideally, you know more about this problem than they do after you do all this questioning. Once you have that narrowed down, then you know where you want to start in terms of how to reproduce the problem. I like to get data closest to the source of the complaint, which is the user. Now, if I can get it from both ends at the same time, that's preferable. But I definitely want to see it from the user's perspective, because they're the ones complaining, and so the packets need to be from that perspective. So you understand the problem very well, the parameters around it, you've designed a reproducible use case. Hopefully it's reproducible. Sometimes, you know, it's not. That's a different type of issue. And you do it, you get the data, so now you know what you're looking for, essentially. And that's the beginning of the approach. And then, of course, it's going to take you in different ways depending on what you find or don't find.
In a sense, it's pretty close to software development, because in software development you do a similar thing. If you get something by the user, the first thing you determine is, I want to have as deterministic approach to reproducing this error. If I can't reproduce the error, I can't find it. I can't fix it.
Right.
There are certain errors which are not reproducible, and you start to go into a more esoteric approach of error handling.
Sure.
Where a lot of key facts are deducted.
Yeah.
Where, okay, I've seen this, I know that, it should be that. And my problem always in that sense, when it goes in that direction, is communication. Because getting the customer to understand the issue, getting the information from the customer is one side. Getting then the compiled information in a way back to the customer so he understands what the problem is.
Right.
That's a completely different ballgame.
That is true. But you make a good point about software development. Even just developing software is a good analogy, because if you don't have a clear set of requirements from product management or the customer, whoever, to go then develop, it's a little wishy-washy. Well, you go develop some software with some features, like, oh no, that's not quite what I wanted, and it's back and forth. But how much time do you waste going back and forth changing the functionality of the software, because we didn't have really clearly defined requirements up front? So that's what I try to do whenever possible when trying to troubleshoot.
Yeah, it's interesting to me, because when you study software development, as I did, you usually, you know, there's always, people tend to think in hierarchies, and they start to fill the jobs in hierarchies. And sadly enough, especially IT and network departments are usually at the lowest scale of those assumed hierarchies. I find it always fascinating, because blame goes always down.
Yeah.
No one is blamed on top, it's always down. Mm-hmm. And at the same time, proof is always going up. You always have to prove, the lower guys always have to prove. I don't know if you coined the term, but there is this saying, truth is always in the packets.
I don't know who came up with it, but yeah, I think everyone knows the packets never lie.
Truth is always there. And it kind of fascinates me, because although we think in those perceived hierarchies, and sadly companies even put salary situations to that, a lot of stuff that we do is pretty much the same. It's just a different kind of tooling, a different kind of identity.
Right.
You mentioned coming from support. I mean, you're one of my favorite kind of people. I always like people in support, especially those that couldn't get rid of issues. I always like those, I named them always support pit bulls, you know, that bite into an issue and just kept on going. Because me as a software developer, I always try to get as close to the customer as possible. And in most modern company, that's no longer the case.
Right.
So the next best thing you have is your support staff.
Yeah.
And I honestly never learned in my personal life as much as I did from guys from support. Mm. The way they think, the way they go about solving issues, that was always something that I tried to emulate. Are you also a development guy? Because a lot of support stuff does scripts. And
I mean, I know enough to be dangerous. You know, I studied computer science, but I never was a professional software developer. So as a sysadmin, I wrote tens and tens of thousands of lines of Perl. Because I built a network system of network monitoring solution on top of RRD tool and SNMP, completely from scratch. Because we were a poor university in Mississippi, there was no money to buy HP OpenView. So this was before like NetDisco and a lot of the other free tools were around, I think. So I wrote one from scratch. It worked pretty well. We eventually built an entire system and network monitoring and management system between our team. It was a great experience. You know, not having a lot of money and resources, actually, if you have the gumption, is a great learning opportunity. So taking those skills to then, you know, a vendor and applying it in support. But I hear what you're saying, you know, around, I always greatly valued my relationship with engineering. I managed to work myself into like one of those backline roles, an escalation role, where my goal was when I wrote something up and gave it to engineering, they go, oh, okay. And they look at the data, I got it, go find the problem in the code, done. Like, make it as easy as I possibly could, not this back and forth. That's one of my great shame stories, is when I spent 2 weeks of engineering time on a performance problem that ended up being a speed and duplex mismatch. very shameful time in my life. But, you know, there's a certain type of person who just enjoys, it's a puzzle. You want to chase. You're not going to stop until you can figure it out. You will stare at packets and log files for a long time trying to figure it out. And of course, when you walk to lunch, that's when it pops in your head, probably.
For me, it's either the toilet or the shower. How many epiphanies I had in the shower on the morning after I was digging down on an issue it's just mind-blowing.
Yeah, you have to pull back, you know, create some space, let your brain, the subconscious, do its thing, and then you'll go, oh, I know what it is.
There is even a Dutch scientist coined a term that's called pressure solution, where they say, okay, if you don't come up with an answer to a really important question, just drink 3 liters of water, wait until you really have to go to the toilet, wait a little bit longer, wait until it's really bursting, and then go. And apparently the release of the pressure together with the rest seems to stimulate our problem-solving centers.
Well, you heard it here. Give it a shot.
Well, it's working. It's to be fair.
Why not?
I mean, most of the people I know, that either it's the shower, it's the toilet, or driving back from work.
Yeah.
Not to work, but home.
Yeah.
It's immediately stepping on the bike or walking to the bus, whatever. And oh yeah, that was it.
Yeah, the last one I remember just hitting me like lightning is, so I eventually left support engineer role and went into management, as you know one does. So not being day to day in the trenches, I wanted to like at least put some of the knowledge I had out. So I made Packet Bomb website and started putting up videos and stuff. And people would email me with issues. I encourage people, like, send me your problems, let me help you solve it, because then it could be a case study. And this guy sent me one. One-way performance problem. One way it was fine, the other way they had a problem, transatlantic. And I looked at it, and it was, packet was dropped, and then there were dupacks. But they kept coming and kept coming, and the sender, even after receiving many, many dupacks, never retransmitted. Mm. Never did a fast retransmit. And I was like, why? Like, what are the reasons why a sender, ascending TCP stack, would not do that? Like, why would it ignore all these acts? I was running through, I couldn't think of it. And I went to lunch, and on the way back from lunch, it just, because, you know, all the different, we talk about, you know, when you're doing analysis, you notice something, you go, that's interesting. Is that the problem? Well, I don't know. You file it away.
Yeah.
And you keep making these little things, and you file them away. And eventually, on the toilet, walking back from California Pizza Kitchen, as I was, they go into place, and I go, I bet it's not looking. It was a problem with a SAC block. You know, it was some Cisco firewall was doing TCP sequence number randomization, you know, changing it in the header, but not changing it in the SAC block. So now they don't match, and it's a bug. So it was an invalid packet, and it got dropped by the stack. It's like, I bet that's what it is. And sure enough, you go back, pull the PCAP up, that was what it was. Those are the really gratifying.
Yeah,
that's what keeps you on the hunt, after the chase, to do it again.
Yeah, and it also gives me situations where I say it can't be that easy in solution, because the more you know, the more complex you imagine the problem is. Something similar. I had a system where I was working machine safety, and every once in a while the machine just went offline. And we, for the life of us, we couldn't figure it out. And I think I spent about 3 days looking at log files, looking at traces, and I couldn't figure it out. Until I realized that I'm getting traces for every second day. I didn't get traces in between. And so I looked what it was, and there was a counter number. And this counter number ran to a certain value, and there was a bug in the software that just couldn't handle the overflow. And at a certain point, it was a 32-bit field, and when it was I think when it was full, completely overran. Yeah, it triggered, and then it said, okay, invalid packet, only one invalid packet, and the machine stopped. And yeah, we fixed the issue, the machine ran, and I was like sitting there in front of my desk. I really can't imagine that walking back, I walked back from the toilet in this case, and I was sitting on the toilet before that, and I'm thinking, no, it can't be that easy. That can't be the solution. That's not the case. We are looking for 3 days. Somebody else would have noticed. That's always the thing. Somebody else would have noticed.
Right.
No, it was that. It was exactly that. Nothing else. And I was like, okay, I give up. Yeah, on one hand, you want to scream it from the rooftops. On the other hand, it's like no one else cares. It's like, problem is solved.
Yeah.
It's
funny.
No, I mean, one thing that you have when you, by the way, your choice of development system, Perl, goes to show that you're really a guy liking punishing himself.
Hey, this was 2000, early 2000s. That's what it was.
I mean, I shouldn't tear open my mouth too big. I started with PHP, but you know. Yeah. Which was aptly named Perl Hypertext Processor.
Hmm.
Because it was as stupid as Perl.
Yeah.
No, but it goes to show that coming from that background, doing this analysis, having all those traces, this is knowledge you can't teach. This is knowledge you can't gain out of.
Right. So now I'm at Zscaler and I'm doing and responsible for technical training for our whole organization. And, you know, I talk about troubleshooting is an art and a science. The science I can teach you. The art, I can't really teach you. You can learn it, but it has to be by your own methods, your own ability, the way you can absorb it, by practice, by seeing other people do it. And some people, they just ain't got it.
Yeah.
But for sure, it's a certain type of person, just they can't let something go. They got to scratch that itch. And other people, like, pack it, smack it. So I'll just figure it out some other way.
Yeah, it's the classical, well, just reboot it every 5 days,
right.
Something like that.
Yeah.
We had that at the previous company. The issue couldn't be resolved. Well, just reboot the machine every five days. And I was like, that can't be a solution.
Well, it should not be, but yes. No, it always get amused, like reading like Reddit, you know, like the networking subreddit, you know, someone will post a problem. You can always, always, always count on people jumping in. Did you check the MTU or DNS? Now, granted, those are two culprits that are, you know, happen frequently, but it's like, you know, yeah, you can reboot it. You can try things and stumble on the answer, or you can have a process.
Yeah.
And then actually, when you do have a lot of years of experience under your belt, you will have an intuition, and you might go MTU without even looking at anything. You might be right. But that comes from the experience and intuition, not just throwing darts at a board and hoping you hit the bullseye.
What I find most problematic, though, when you come onto the table with intuition, is explaining that is even harder.
Mm-hmm.
And you're betting your whole currency on that problem every time. Because you're saying, basically, you know what I can do, and I'm telling you this is the issue.
Yeah.
And, I mean, we are both divorcees. We know how hard it is to discuss with somebody who has a different point of view than you do.
Yeah.
But it's this kind of set you have where you know there is no way you can explain it. You know there is no way you can prove it. But also you know it's that issue.
Well, and ideally you've sort of earned your cred by that point.
Yeah.
You talked about earlier pressure coming down or whatever. One of the things I actually enjoyed being pulled into an escalation where it was like super hot and the customer was rah, rah, rah. Because if I could solve it, then I get on the call and I don't care what they're saying, how much they're yelling, here's the data. Because they're like, it's your problem. And a lot of times it wasn't because, you know, we're in an ecosystem, you know. You got firewalls and routers and switches and they all have their own software. They can have bugs. And sometimes it was in their network. And being able to point at the data and speak authoritatively, you know, with confidence, this is what the data says, this is the problem, the next step, Mr. Customer or Ms. Customer, is to do this. And they, many times, they'll just kind of be quiet and do it. Yeah. They may still yell a little bit, But once you've earned, you know, that credibility, then you gain the ability to say, I think it's this.
I always enjoy situations like that because you can't lose. If you can't solve the issues, well, it's been burning for quite some time. Yeah. It's not your fault. Yeah. But if you solve it, you're the hero of the day.
People talk sometimes negatively about a hero complex or whatever, but I think in this line of work, I don't think it's a bad thing. And I used to love parachute in and solve the problem that no one else could.
Well, it's not a bad thing per se. It's good when you'll have to celebrate your victories.
Yeah.
That you're gonna have to do. It's a frustrating field. It's often enough that you have issues which you can't solve or that takes you forever to solve them. So you do have to celebrate your victories.
Right.
At the same time, you shouldn't hang them under other people's noses.
No, definitely That's not. The thing. Definitely not. Yeah. No, like, hey, we solved it. My thing is, we solved it. There was a lot of people involved.
Yeah.
It's a team effort. We made the customer happy. Move on to the next one. Honestly, I've eaten it many times. I have been wrong. I have led us in, I mean, the speed and duplex one notwithstanding, other times you go in a direction and it's a dead end. And yeah. Everyone's been going with you because you're the, quote, expert. And you're like, whoops, let's turn around and try again. So it goes both ways.
Yeah. No, it's also, you know, you're the expert. You're the one who says, okay, let's turn around. This was a dead end, and people follow. And this is also something you can do as an expert. You can't do it as a novice where you say, okay, this is wrong, we follow. Then people just say, oh, he doesn't know his thing. Mm. You can say with authority, okay, the approach we tried, this was the first one, it doesn't work. What next?
Yeah.
What's the next step? Yeah. No, I enjoy this. It's so now you're at Zscaler doing technical trainings and leading other trainers, I presume?
Yeah, so we have a whole technical enablement team, so we're responsible for the onboarding. New people get hired, what do they need to learn? What are the gaps in skills? How are people doing continuous? You know, I've done Wireshark training, because why not? And then interacting with what are we hearing from customers or from our teams that this particular feature is hard to troubleshoot? Well, what supportability options can we add to it to make it easier? New tools to troubleshoot to make our life easier. That's the kind of stuff I'm focused on now.
And would you say it's a natural progression coming from support going towards training, or is it?
Yeah, I mean, well,
is it more your interest driven?
Yeah, it's so the my team is like the center of excellence, right? It's a discipline to look at, kind of stand outside the organization and go, okay, how do we make this thing better, move faster, quicker, more efficient? So the fact that, you know, I've taken this one thing that I've done, packet analysis, and become a teacher and you know, taught a lot of people how to do it, this is just kind of taking that concept and blowing it up to a much bigger scope. But like I said, the packet thing is still there. I still run little case studies and trainings and stuff.
Because you have to be on point. You have to be you have to stay active.
Yeah, you do. You do. I mean, I obviously I don't look at packets nearly like I used to. But you know, something will come my way, like, hey, we're struggling with this. Could you just take a quick look? I mean, I'll do that sometimes, but not too much because, you know, I have a lot of other responsibilities, but I do enjoy it. So I try to make time to look at things on a regular basis, at least to, you know, make sure I remember what, you know, an IP address is.
Yeah. It's pretty much like you do when you have, learned any other skill. Practice makes proficiency. You do have to practice. You don't have, at a certain level, you don't have to practice as often to keep that level if you don't want to exceed further.
Yeah.
But you do have to practice. And after, I mean, I get it. In software development, it's a similar thing because as I'm now turning mid-40 in half a year or so, software development is a young game. It's a young boys game. It's a young girls game. And because they have the patience to struggle with the code, they have the issues, they have the mind-numbing hours. Those are all young people's games.
Right.
And you have all this experience, which on the one hand makes you perfect for hard cases, but at the same time also hinders you to see the easy solutions.
Mm-hmm.
Because you automatically go to, this has to be perfect, this has to be complex, this has to be maintainable forever and stuff like that. So in software development, I found that most people tend to naturally move towards an architectural role or a managerial role. Right. Also, a lot of people go into completely different fields like sales and stuff like that. It's just, there seems to be a cap at mid-30s something where most people change. And it's interesting because in network analysis, it's a similar thing. You start, you start to teach, you start to educate other people, or you move on to other roles.
Yeah, I mean, some I've worked with engineers who are in their 60s and they're still just, they love it. That's all, they don't want to do anything else. I'm like, that's great. that you found your thing and you're good. But yeah, other people want to move on to, it could be management, it could be architect, it could be something else. But you're building on that base knowledge and skill set that honestly is, like I said, when I was a system and network admin with no real resources and just had to learn it, I built on top of that going to a company that sold a Linux and networking box. It's perfect. You take all these skills and then just build on each other to wherever you want to go.
Okay. Thank you. That was really great. Thank you for having the time to come here and talk to me. Yeah.
Thanks for inviting me.
And seeing you in a lot of future SharkFests, hopefully.
I hope so. Come see us.
Thank you for listening to this installment of the SharkBytes podcast. If you want to stay informed about upcoming episodes, please subscribe to our podcast at YouTube or your podcasting platform of choice. My name is Roland Klaal. See you next time.